Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
You're forgiven if the debate over deficits and spending reductions has you feeling like you're at the tennis match. You turn to the left and they're fighting for higher taxes than the rich. You turn to the right, they're screaming class warfare and claiming that it can all be fixed by spending cuts and no revenue. A 12-member super committee is supposed to be weighing all of those and coming up with a bipartisan solution. But our next guest says none of this is correct. And in fact, all of these debates miss the real point. Joining us now, Joe Nocera, columnist for our partner, The New York Times. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. So if all of that is sort of meaningless, as you write in your column, what has meaning? What's the real point here?
Well, the real point is lack of credit. Just to cut to the chase here. There's nothing wrong with deficit reduction, although I happen to think that the timing for deficit reduction right now is insane. There's certainly nothing wrong with a jobs program or stimulus, which can help on the margins. But history shows, and even current statistics or current numbers show, that what kills an economy is the lack of credit. And there is no credit is very, very hard to come by right now in this country. And what revives an economy is credit. And so just to take one simple example, we're not even talking about small business or corporations. What often leads to recovery is the revival of housing. The United States does not have a housing policy. There is no credit available for housing, except that which is guaranteed by Fannie and Freddie. So, unless you have sort of regular, normalized credit standards for housing, you're not going to get a revival of the housing sector.
Well, we're speaking with Joe Nocera, who is a columnist for our partner, The New York Times, and you said history shows us that this is true. And in fact, in your column, you go back to the Great Depression and the post-World War II. Give me some historical examples.
Well, okay, the Great Depression is the great historical example. From 1930 to 1932, which was the really worst of the Depression. There was not only a lack of credit, but it was exacerbated by very, very tight monetary policy by the Fed. So, in other words, the Fed wasn't trying to counteract the lack of credit; it was actually encouraging a lack of credit, which just completely choked off the economy. Then you get Roosevelt in 1933. And for the next 4 years, when he's throwing spaghetti at the wall like crazy and stimulating like crazy, and the Fed policies are very different, for the next 4 years, believe it or not, even though we all think of that as depression, they're four of the strongest growth years in the history of the United States. Then you get to 1937, everybody decides, oh, okay, well, we've had enough loose money and we've had enough expansionist fiscal policy, so let's tighten up again. And guess what happens in 1937? We go right back, spiraling back into depression.
So let's look at what the Fed is considering doing actually this week, Joe, because, they're trying to encourage looser credit for long-term interest rates and trying to get this to trickle down to people who maybe don't have the best credit ratings, who maybe aren't, who suffered, grievously during the financial meltdown. How do you sort of push the string, as economists say? How do you get the banks to actually lend to people who aren't the best, the low-hanging fruit, the easiest, sort of most credit-worthy customers?
Well, I have come to the view, reluctantly, that you kind of have to forget about the banks, that they're hopeless. There's really not much you can do about them. Partly they're scared. Partly they have overreacted to the credit bubble. Partly they're worried about, look, if the European contagion comes across the ocean to the United States, they're going to be back in trouble again. So, of course, they're afraid to lend. They're hoarding their own capital. So what the Fed has done is kind of cut the banks out of the action and gone sort of into a direct buying program, and that's what quantitative easing has been all about. You go to a money market fund, and you basically buy bonds out of that fund, and you give them cash. Where does that cash come from? Well, basically, the Fed invents it. Yes, it prints money, and that's where the inflation specter comes from. But that money helps, that money circulates and it becomes a form of credit. And it's not as good as having the banks involved, because the banks can leverage that money 7-to-1, 8-to-1, 9-to-1, and a money market fund cannot do that, and an investor cannot do that. But it's something. And that's what the Fed's been trying to do.
We're speaking with Joe Nocera, a columnist for our partner, the New York Times. And, in fact, you're calling on Ben Bernanke to do just that, right? I mean, you're yeah. hoping that we get a QE3.
Right. I'm sticking my neck out here, let's be honest.
Well, Ben Bernanke's the one that's going to have to stick his neck out.
Right, right. That's right. So for now, Rick Perry can accuse me of borderline treason. And that's the problem. And one of the things I've been trying to – the point I tried to make in the column is the Fed is politically independent precisely so that Bernanke can do unpopular things in the face of, you know, political heat, frankly. He's insulated from that. And the example that I use is Paul Volcker 30 years ago, who did a very unpopular thing. It was the opposite of loose money. It was tight, tight, tight money. He was trying to squeeze inflation out of the economy. And he was reviled.
And that's a good thing. So, I mean, Bernanke taking heat is a sign that he's actually doing something. Is that your view?
Say that again.
Bernanke taking heat from Republicans, referred to Rick Perry, is actually a good sign that he's making some sparks here.
That's what I believe. I mean, for him to do the politically popular thing right now would only be to make things worse. And one of the most frustrating things about this whole economic mess that we're in right now is you feel like nobody's read a history book, and you want to grab these guys by the throat and say, fellas, don't you read what happened in the 1930s? Don't you understand that the path that you're on is ruinous for the economic situation that we're in right now? And the answer is they don't. They all think if we can just balance the budget, everything will be fine. And in fact, it will make things much worse.
And in fact, you're saying Ben Bernanke, villain of today and hero of tomorrow.
If he does what I tell him to do.
Joe Nocera, columnist for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Let us know
guys.
If you get a call back, Joe.
Yeah, right. Pat chance, fellas.
From either Bernanke or Perry.
Or Obama.
Yeah, there you go. And we're going to be talking about Obama and his perhaps tonal shift. Maybe he's ready to be reviled by the right anyway. That's coming up in 10 minutes. But do you think that confrontation is what's going to happen in Washington in the next year or so? Or back to compromise? Do you see any possibility for compromise? 8778, my take.